is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who loves to hear the story behind the book. My name is Patsy Gill. My guest today is Nuala O'Connor, who is on a whirlwind tour of America from her home in Ireland. And I'm very excited to talk to her about her wonderful book, Miss Emily. We're going to talk in a minute. I just want to play a little song to set us in the mood. Nuala, are you there?
I am. Hello, Patsy. Nice to speak to you.
Oh, it's nice to speak to you. Well, I love your accent so much that I would speak to you just to talk about porridge.
That's very sweet.
There's nothing as it's really music to my ears to listen to an Irish accent. So how are you enjoying your tour?
Oh, it's fantastic. It's up to now, it's been bookstores, and they're so welcoming. I feel like the independent bookstores here are so good at what they do. Their shops are inclusive, they have great range of products, and the staff are just super at their jobs. It's been really, really nice.
Well, I'm sure your fans are enjoying having the opportunity to meet you, and I know that in 2 days you're going to be appearing in a very exciting venue there in Amherst. Tell us about Miss Emily and what it means for you to be right there in her hometown to talk about this wonderful book you've written about Emily Dickinson.
It's fantastic. When I had finished a first draft of the novel 2 years ago, I traveled to Amherst to visit the Emily Dickinson Museum, which is made up of Emily's home and her brother Austin's home. They're practically side by side on the same plot of land. And I had a first draft written, and so I really traveled to gain colour. You know, it's a research trip like that adds a lot to what you have already done. It gives you a very firm understanding to walk the land that the person walked. And I just was so moved to be in her home, particularly her bedroom. It was almost heart-stopping to stand there, having spent so much time in that room in my head in the previous year or so writing the book. I was very lucky the day I went there that the guide who took me around, there was just myself and himself, because I was the only person who turned up that morning, as luck would have it. And he was fantastic. And really, his tour just became a conversation between two Emily Dickinson enthusiasts. And he taught me a lot. And actually, we stayed in touch. And he helped me subsequently with bits of research when I needed to know something. So really, going to that museum was, it was like the, what would you say, the icing on the cake.
It's so exciting to think of you being there on Saturday, and I'm sure so many fans will turn out because, one, of course, Emily Dickinson has so many fans here in the United States. She is still, you know, the most beloved poetess, you know, of the United States. And it's funny, recently I've been really deeply involved in poetry. I love poetry, but I hadn't been involved in it for several years, and then recently I interviewed our new poet laureate here in the United States, Juan Herrera, and he's taking his position in September. And so I got back into poetry, and as I'm reading Emily Dickinson, and I was so happy, you know, when they sent me your book and they said, you know, would you like to interview Nuala O'Connor? And I said yes, and it was only after I read it that I realized that I had read one of your books, but not with that name on it. You have another name.
I do. I was educated through the Irish language, which you probably know as the Gaelic language.
Yes.
And so from the age of 4, when I entered primary school, when you go to one of those schools, as my children now do, your name is put back to its Gaelic form. So I have been called Nuala Ní Cruachóir since I was 4 years old. I was christened Nuala O'Connor, but the Gaelic form of my name, I kept it because I went on to do a BA in Irish and then an MA in Irish, and it just felt more natural for me to keep my name. And then just my agent and Penguin, when they bought the book, asked if I would mind reverting to my birth name, just to make it easier for people to say, spell, and remember my name if they wanted to buy the book. And it makes a lot of sense in actual fact.
It does, but your book that I had read previously, which is Closet...
The Closet of Savage Mementos.
Yes, Closet of Savage Mementos, which is a fantastic book, and I know that we're on the Miss Emily tour, but I hope that people will look up your webpage and look you up in Amazon. And I know the book is available on Kindle, and it's a wonderful book, set in Scotland. And I would highly recommend it to people. So, but I was pleasantly surprised when I discovered that you had moved. Of course, that was a very contemporary book set in Scotland. And now, how did you decide to write a book? I know all of you Irish people have poetry in your heart. And did you always love Emily Dickinson?
Yes. I mean, we learned her at school from about the age of 10. And then for my final exams at school, you take two poets for the exam. And I took Emily and the Irish poet Patrick Kavanagh. Just loved her poetry, loved the incisiveness, loved the sort of treatise she does on mental health and on death and on life itself, nature. She's a wonderful nature poet. So really, really loved her poetry as a teenager. And then kind of, you know, kept aware of her over the years, but wouldn't have been as devoted until I heard that she loved to bake, and I love to bake. And so I began to bake Emily's recipes for coconut cake and gingerbread and black cake. And all around that time, I wrote a poem about Emily as baker. But the idea of her and baking wouldn't let me go. And I was musing, thinking to myself, wouldn't it have been fantastic if she had had Irish maids? Because so many Irish immigrants, post-famine and pre-famine in Ireland, worked as domestics, young women. Discovered then, through research, that indeed Emily had had several Irish maids. So that's where the genesis of the novel was sown. Poetry, baking, Irish emigration. And I felt it was an audacious thing to do, to take on an American icon. So I tiptoed around it. But there's a thing, when you get an idea for a novel like that, and it coalesces in that lovely way, it's very hard then for you to forget about it. So you eventually just have to sit down and make a start, and I did.
Well, you did a wonderful job of it's a back and forth method where you have Emily talking and then Ada talking. Ada, of course, is the maid who comes from Ireland, and it's just, I think it's brilliantly done. It really moves the story along, and of course Ada's story is so compelling. What she goes through in that brief time that she is, you said it in a year where you didn't interrupt any real maids in the history, and her story is compelling, and I love the way that you've handled Emily and shown her as a different from how people sort of perceive her as a. I think a lot of people think of her as sort of sullen, quiet, miserable, or something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and she wasn't at all like that.
No, I think we have one of two images in our head about Emily, and the first one is maybe the daguerreotype of her when she was 16, and she looks quite, I don't know, sort of prim and maybe a little bit severe in it. She's wearing black. Her hair is parted in the centre of her head. I love the image myself, but I think a lot of people associate that with her. She was 16, as I said, when that was taken. And then maybe the second image we have in our head is of this ghostly recluse who's all angsty and downbeat and thinking about her own death. Whereas in actual fact, Emily, when you read her letters, she was extremely loquacious, she was funny, she was witty, she loved to riddle, she loved in-jokes. And she only had a small number of friends that she kept in touch with solidly. But she was extremely devoted to them, and she had very strong friendships with those people. Whether that was through letters or face-to-face, both mostly. So she was a very committed friend and a very funny individual. Her letters are hilarious often. They're often quite cryptic as well. But she had a wonderful, as we know, a wonderful way with words in poetry, but also in prose. If anybody is interested in Emily, there are many fine biographies, but her own letters actually are quite a good starting point.
So when you were started, as you said, you did your first draft still in Ireland, and so you must have done quite a bit of research reading the books and her letters there.
Yep, I did. I tend to research as I write because I think it's something to do with the fact I'm so impatient. I can't wait to get started on the writing, and so I don't want to spend a year just researching and taking notes. So what I do is I research at night and take my notes, and then I get up in the morning and I write. So not late into the night or anything. I actually read the books lying in bed and take my notes, and then I get up and I write. And if I need to research as I go, I'll break off just for a few minutes. I try not to get carried away because research is very seductive. It really sucks you in, you know. You go off on these lovely tangents looking at Victorian women's wear and, you know, researching the food of the era, etc. So I try to keep the research not separate completely, but separate-ish, so that when I'm in the flow of the actual writing, that's what I'm allowed to do. I just sit and do that. I read up to about 30 books by and about Emily. I'm still buying books. I'm here in the States again, and I'm still buying books about Emily. She's irresistible to me. And I think that's what happens when you fall for Emily and when you read about her life and the lives of those around her. You become sort of addicted. She's very easy to love, you know, because of her vivacity and her absolutely wonderful way with words.
And you really bring out how, you know, life for a Victorian woman, for women at that time, of course, was so domestic. And it was always such a challenge for her that she wanted all this time to write. So the need for a maid was very important to her.
It was. Now, she and her sister Lavinia, or Vinnie as she was known, they were well-trained in the domestic arts by their mother. A lot of the time, the Dickinson family didn't have a maid. And so Emily and Vinnie had to know how to run the house along with their mother, and their mother made sure that they did. The mother was also a wonderful gardener, and they got their love of flowers from her, probably, initially. And then they actually studied botany at school. Emily didn't go to school a lot, because her father worried about her health and used to drag her home, you know. But she, the mother taught them well. And then when they did have domestics, they still helped out. There was no question of them idling in their rooms or anything like that. So Emily was always looking for time in which to write.
Which is the most precious thing to a writer.
Well, that's it. That's all there is, really, isn't there? There's you, time, and the page. And there is nothing else that you require. But, you know, again, if you want to be a writer, you have to make that time. So if that means getting up at 5 a.m. before you go to work or school or whatever it is, you have to do it. But I think when you have the call to be a writer, you will do it no matter what. It's not a case of picking or choosing. It's almost like a vocation. It's like something that is constantly whispering in your ear and you can't ignore it. So when you meet people who say, oh, they'll write a book one day, you just nod and smile and say, yeah, yeah. You know, if you wanted to write a book, Macy, you'd be writing it now, you know.
Exactly. About Ada, where did you get your inspiration for her? Did you have any, Irish people, I think half of Ireland must have relatives who came to the States. Did you have any relatives in your family who emigrated to the States in those years?
No, funny enough, we're one of the few families in Ireland that don't have American cousins. It's very strange, but I think it may be the fact that I was brought up in Dublin, and a lot of the emigrants actually left from outside of Dublin, from the west of Ireland and the south of Ireland particularly. So Ada's family, Ada is fictional, but I made her a cousin of Maggie Marr, who was one of Emily Dickinson's most famous Irish maids. So I made her a cousin of Maggie so that I could use Maggie's personal history and family history. So they emigrated from Munster, Tipperary, Maggie's family. They went en masse, actually, her parents and her siblings and herself. And so I have Ada's mother be, say, her aunt's, Maggie's mother's sister, so that they're first cousins. So I went as well, in the research for Ada, I went down to Fettard in Tipperary and Schlieffmon, which is the mountain where Maggie Marr's people were from. And I walked the land there and I looked at the flora and fauna, just so I'd know where Ada's real people came from, even though she's a fictional character. And then I made her actually be from County Dublin, where I'm from, a place called Palmerstown, which the ancient name of which was Tigora, And for the sake of sounding more Irish, I reverted it to its ancient name for the book. And then I read a lot of emigrant letters as well to get a picture of what people said to each other in letters. Not much, as it turns out. A lot of blessings, and I hope that your passage went well, and may God bless you and keep you. The letters were rarely very newsy, you know, even though both sides were probably looking forward to news. I guess these were people who would have probably left school around the age of 11 or 12. They might have been literate all right, but not comfortable writing. As you know, Irish people are more comfortable talking. So the letters tended to be a little bit stiff. So in a sense, I had to make a new voice for Ada, where she was, you know, much chattier than she probably would have been on the page in real life. But like all fiction, it's a trick. You're trying to pull off a kind of a trick. And you mentioned the fact that it's a dual narrative, where the one chapter is in Ada's voice and the next chapter is Emily's, and so on throughout the book. And it's important for me that they're both talkers. Emily and Ada are both talkers, and it's a cross-generational friendship. And they talk to each other a lot in the kitchen, where Emily spent a lot of time because she loved to bake and cook. And the novel is a great conversation between the two women, and it's a learning conversation. Emily watches fondly as Ada falls in love with one of the other Irish workers on the land. And Emily teaches Ada about, you know, other things in life. So, the novel is about friendship. It's about the mistress-servant relationship, and it's about Irish immigration and emigration.
And you have done a beautiful job of writing with such details and with bringing the time and the period to life. That was really, I think, one of the remarkable things one gets when one reads the book.
Yeah, I'm very interested in social history, and I'm also very interested in the physical landscape of places, including buildings. And so when I went to Amherst to do final research, they have wonderful libraries there, the Jones Library and the Frost Library, and they all have aspects of the Dickinson life recorded, but also aspects of town life. And so I was able to look at the rows of shops in old photographs as they would have looked at Emily's and Ada's time. And so I could build in my head a sort of a pretty good picture of what Amherst looked like physically back then. And that's important to me. I'm a real setting person when it comes to fiction. I love the setting to loom very large and for the reader really to feel like they're in the place. I mean, you don't always know as a writer if you have succeeded with that, so I'm glad to hear that you felt that worked. For me, it's important. You can't have your characters in some nowhere in particular place. They have to be, for the sake of the reader, so the reader feels anchored into the thing. It's good for you to describe the setting well. And I love a bit of purple prose anyway, you know. Because my initial thing was poetry, I tend to love describing things. I try not to do it at length. Anyway, my editor's chopped out a whole bunch of it. But I think we left enough to get a good flavour of Amherst and the time, which was the mid-1860s.
Oh, definitely. It really conjures up a vision, so much so that at one point I said, wow, you know, I could almost make a film script out of this and you know, see this as I was seeing it as a film in my head, which is I think a wonderful accomplishment.
Yes, I think when we write, we try to make things almost filmic. We try to make them vivid, and when something is vivid, it should play almost like a film in someone's head. Film rights to the book have been optioned, and I just got news that a screenwriter has been appointed, and it's somebody I really respect. I can't actually say who it is, but she's well-known, and her father is a well-known film director as well, so I'm very happy about that, and I'm crossing everything that the film goes ahead, because as you know, these projects often, you know, fall at some strange hurdle that we, the writers, don't understand, but it's looking good so far.
Oh, it must be something that's going to happen, because as I was saying, when I read it and I'm thinking, this is a film, I can see it being done, and I have a feeling that it will be made, because it's a kind of film, you know, as what we call, you know, sort of in the business, a small film, but big with emotion, big with a wonderful story that you've brought together here, combining Ada and Emily in such a very intriguing way. And of course, the other part, some of the other members of the family, her relationship with her brother,
yes,
and her brother's wife. So it's really an intriguing story, and I think it's going to make a wonderful film.
I hope so. I saw the trailer recently to Cullum Tobin's novel Brooklyn, which is coming out, I think, in November. And watching that trailer and how beautifully it's done, I got a sudden vision myself of how beautifully Miss Emily could be done on film. And it just gave me a real whoosh, you know, that kind of way. I just felt, oh, wow, I can see how this could be gorgeous, you know.
Well, no, exactly. That's what I got when I was reading the book. You know, I was sort of like two-thirds the way through, and I realized I've been seeing this all along as a film in my head. And that's, I think that's one of the biggest compliments, because, you know, when a book can do that, when a book can come so alive, you've done a great job. That's all I can say.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, so many writers who have had films, have had novels optioned, have been warning me to, you know, don't get too excited and don't get.
Oh, I know. They come and they go. And I myself have adapted some books for film, which for various reasons. I wrote one time a script for a book, a love story, a beautiful love story, and we were like 3 days from, you know, ready to go into production, and suddenly, because it was based on a book, a biography of two people who were supposed to be madly in love, and a few days before production, there was headlines about a major divorce.
No way. That is so awful.
Oh, it was awful. But of course, you know, you do that, and you put, you know, as a writer, you put all your ideas into this. And I had, of course, done all these interviews, you know, to add to the book. And it was just, it was fantastic. And I had really, I think I wrote a beautiful love story based on this book. And then suddenly, to wake up a few days, like on a, we were supposed to start production, you know, pre-production on a Monday, and on Friday morning, I wake up and the headlines, I mean, literally the headlines in the newspaper. I mean,
goodness
this
me.
This was unbelievable.
They not have just stayed in love, you know, damn them anyway.
Oh, I said, at least, you know, afterwards, I said to the guy, I said, why? You're such an idiot. I said, you couldn't wait a year.
Yeah.
You know, why do you have to fool around with some young girl just when I'm ready to...
my big break. I know, it's like, you know, people keep giving me these warnings and all, but I don't know, and it's not really like me. I'm a terrible worrier, but I just feel quietly optimistic about this. For some reason, I think it's... I've met the people involved, and they're so sincere and so committed, and I know the films they've made already, and I'm just feeling hopeful.
Well, you know, the funny thing, when I see it in my head, generally it comes true. And so I really feel that this has to be on the screen. and that you're going to have a wonderful film out of this. And maybe you'll invite me to the premiere.
Absolutely.
Because I believe in this book. You know, it's funny, as I was saying, recently I interviewed somebody else, and I hadn't related the name. She had a different name from her parents, and I didn't realize who she was until I interviewed her. And then I realized, my goodness, I had read her mother's book like 20 years before. And it's so funny when I run across this, where, you know, I had read, you know, your other book years ago. I mean, Closet of Savage Mementos. What year did that come out?
It came out spring last year.
Yeah. A year and a half ago. And
yes.
Because, well, I read anything about, well, I love Scotland. Well, I love the Irish accent. And the funny thing is, I like books about Scotland, and so it's set, of course, in Scotland, and it's a fascinating story. And so it was funny when, you know, I related your name to that book. So it's...
I'm delighted you came across it, you know, because it's only published in Ireland, you know.
So yes, and it's on Kindle.
It is on Kindle.
It's on Kindle.
That's
how I got it, because, you know, But of course, this is a. It certainly showed, and you know what a great writer you are, and I'm so happy that you got this deal for you know for Miss Emily. I think it's wonderful. They've done a wonderful job of promoting you, and I know that this is going to be a very successful tour for you, and I'm hoping that you know. You'll really enjoy this trip to America and remember it well.
I am. I'm thoroughly enjoying it. You know, Penguin have been great. They have really got behind the book, and my agent has been fantastic.
Who's your agent? Let's give her.
Yeah, my agent is Grainne Fox. She works with Fletcher & Co. in New York, and she's also from Dublin, but has been living in New York for a number of years. And she's just fantastic, and she really believed in this book when she just saw the first 30 pages.
Well, I love when writers, you know, compliment their agents because sometimes people forget, you know, the role of the agent, and it's so important, you know, to getting a book out and to getting it out and to getting it done well. So
yeah, it's crucial, and I think the thing is, this Grainne is actually my third agent. I've had two previous agents that didn't work out, and I think the point is for anybody looking for an agent is. You have to find the right agent for you so that your friend may have an agent who's right for them, but that person may not be right for you. So I knew what I wanted from an agent by the time I was looking for Grainne, who I then found. You know, I really wanted someone who I could communicate with very openly and very freely and someone who communicated back quickly, you know. I found that with the previous two, communication was very slow and very patchy, and that's not what you want from the relationship. You want somebody who you can really lay your heart on the line to about what it is you want from the writing experience and from the publishing experience, you know. And she has just been fantastic, I have to say. I'm thrilled I met her. I hope we're together for life, let me put it that way.
Well, I'm sure she's very proud of bringing out this book and bringing you out to the public. And as I said, you've done a beautiful job in Miss Emily and making her come alive with all the details. Somehow I had missed that Emily Dickinson had red hair, and I think, I don't know why,
yes.
That had such an impact on me. I like people with red hair, and I thought...
Me too.
I love it. I loved it. You know that.
Yeah, I think it goes back to that daguerreotype from when she was 16, because obviously it's not in colour. It looks like she has black hair, and so we have this image of her as dark, dark, dark in appearance and in subject matter. And in actual fact, the opposite was true. She had the most divine, coppery, bright red hair. You can see a lock of it in the Frost Library in Amherst. I went to see it, and again, it was so moving to look at this. It's not like Irish red hair, you know, the kind of postcard red hair. It's more like a very shiny, auburny red. Very, very beautiful. She must have had incredible hair to stand and look at her. She must have been so striking, you know, and particularly in contrast with the white dresses she turned to later in life. So she was a redhead.
I love that. I thought that was a wonderful detail to come out. Well, I want to thank you so much for being on my show today. It's, you know, my show is really, I try to encourage people to read and not, you know, and for writers who are already writing, but they need motivation because sometimes it's really hard. They like... You know, they're working and working and they're thinking, when is it going to come? When is, you know, success going to come? But they just have to keep plugging away. And
that's the thing. It's as much about tenacity as talent. And, I mean, this is my 11th book and I've only just now been published, had a novel published outside of Ireland. So, you know, if I had given up on book 5, I wouldn't be here. So just keep the ink flowing and keep sitting down and doing it every day if you can. 5 days a week, at least.
And are you already working on your next book?
Yes, it's another Victorian novel, but it's set mostly in London and partially in Ballinasloe in County Galway, where I live. And it's about the local Viscount who married a dance hall girl, and it was a bit of a scandal. And she was this incredibly beautiful young woman. So it's a great story. So fingers crossed, my agent and my editors will like it, and hopefully in the next couple of years it will appear on shelves.
Okay, and I hope that you'll come back on my program because, one, I could listen to you all day. I just love your voice, and I would love to promote your book and tell everyone really that they have to read Miss Emily, and we'll keep our fingers crossed that in a few years it takes that long.
Yeah.
But to see the film, because it is worthy of being read and being treasured as another addition to learning about our great American Emily Dickinson and to share in the love that you have for her.
Exactly. Thank you so much, Patsy. It's been lovely talking to you.
Oh, it's been a joy to talk to you.
All the best with your own writing and with the writing of your listeners.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye now.
Bye-bye.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, I'm John Rakowski with Charles Ruttenberg Realty. Don't you love living here in the Tampa Bay area? Oh, I'm sorry, you don't live here yet? Well, if you already are or thinking about it, call me at my office at 727-538-9200 extension 2 for any real estate needs, including a free market analysis of your home. Your home is worth more than you can imagine. Call me today at 727-538-9200 extension 2. I'm John Rakowski.
Are you looking for the perfect gift? Going to a wedding? A special birthday? The Silver Queen is the place to go. Don't settle for the ordinary. At the Silver Queen, you will find a unique gift. Things that you won't find at the mall. From beautiful photo frames to silver and china. Guys, looking for that perfect ring? You'll find it at the Silver Queen. And don't forget their bridal registry. Located at 1350 West Bay Drive in Largo. Visit their website, silverqueen.com. They have some wonderful coupons. And when you go to the store, tell them that Patsy with a Z sent you.
Arg, matey. When it's time for lunch, when it's time for dinner, when the show's over, when the day's over, when it's time to chill, where do we go? Over to Naughty Nancy's Food Shack and Crow's Nest Pub. It's literally in our backyard, right in back of the WTAN studios at 700 Eldridge Street, just north of downtown Clearwater. Just look for the broadcast tower. Nancy's food and atmosphere get rave reviews. The laid-back patio is a great place to hang out, dine, and listen to live music at night. And Nancy's one of the friendliest proprietors in town. And now, Nancy is serving Sunday Jazz Brunch from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Brunch served with Eggs Benedict, crepes, waffles, lox and bagels, shrimp, oysters, and a build-your-own omelet. That's all at Naughty Nancy's Food Shack and Crow's Nest Pub, 700 Eldridge Street in Clearwater. That's right where Eldridge crosses the Pinellas Trail between Myrtle and Fort Harrison. Call 446-3717. 446-3717.
You're listening to the Tantalk Radio Network.
At the Oaks of Clearwater, you'll enjoy a lifestyle to fit your needs. From independent living, assisted living, memory care, and skilled nursing. Our exciting independent lifestyle is the perfect combination of freedom, comfort, and security. Enjoy total independence with peace of mind. Our independent lifestyle includes chef-prepared meals in our beautiful waterfront dining room, a continental breakfast, all utilities, including cable and telephone, housekeeping with linen service, scheduled transportation, including trips for shopping, local restaurants, theater, and more. Our activities program is second to none. At the Oaks of Clearwater, you'll enjoy affordable luxury waterfront senior living with a million-dollar view. Call today, 727-445-4069, and discover where caring, compassionate service really makes the difference.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. My name is Patsy Gill. I'm happy to have in the studio with me today Jackie Minniti, who has written a very interesting book called The Project June Bug. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, Patsy.
So tell us about Project June Bug. How did that come about? You were a teacher for 25 years.
Yes.
And so this is based on your experience as a teacher and with particularly with with what type of students?
With the ADHD kids. When I was teaching kindergarten, this was back in the late 80s, I noticed that every year I would have two or three kids who just were so puzzling to me. They were kids who were bright. They were kids who were, they should be, the kids who should be succeeding in school, but they were so antsy and so inattentive that they were running into all kinds of problems. The behavior became a problem. The learning became the problem. The listening became a problem. And it was frustrating to me because I couldn't figure out what it was that was causing the problem so that I knew how to change my approach with them to make things a little better for them. And we had one afternoon a faculty workshop where Dr. Carlo Molini spoke to the faculty, and he told us about this newly identified condition called attention deficit disorder. Back then it was known as ADD. Previously to that, they had called it minimal brain dysfunction because they thought that there was something in the brain that was amiss. And as I was listening to him describing the behaviors and talking about what these kids experience, it was like light bulbs going on in my head, because everything that he was saying synced with what I was seeing in the classroom, that I couldn't figure out what was causing it. And I realized that actually what I was seeing was a child with a deficit of attention, because that's where the problem was. They just couldn't focus long enough to be able to achieve in a classroom. And at the time, there was very little research on the condition. They were just starting to do some studies. So I found everything I could find and read up on it, and I tried to keep up on all of the news in the field. And when I went to study for my master's degree, I decided that I was going to do my project on ways that teachers can modify their instruction to benefit these children.
And so as a result of this and of your experience, you came out with a novel,
mm-hmm.
And it's about a teacher whose name is Jenna Bianchi.
Bianchi, yes.
And about what happens in her classroom.
Yes.
And how did you come out with the idea to tell it from a teacher's perspective?
Well, I had transitioned during my career from kindergarten to 7th and 8th grade reading. And it was funny because some of the same children I had in kindergarten were being cycled through again through my classes when I had them as 7th and 8th graders. And it was interesting to see that the kids who had the problem in kindergarten had the same problem in 7th and 8th grade. But by then, a lot of them were really turned off to school. They had been having negative experiences right on through. They'd become troublemakers. They got into trouble at home, at school. They were just really turned off. And so I wanted them to see the teacher as an advocate, because I found that when I related to the kids that way, it was almost surprising to them because they'd been having such negative experiences all along. But because I knew what was in their heads and what they were going through, it made it easier for me to kind of empathize with them. And I wanted them to read this book and see this teacher as somebody who was really going to bat for them with all she had, so that maybe that would help change their view of what teachers were like. And what started out to be a young adult book, eventually, because the teacher was going to be the narrator of the story, turned into an adult book. But it still has the self-help element in it, and that's the thing I think makes the book unique. It's a hybrid self-help / novel, and at the end of the book, I have a list of strategies that parents and teachers can use that were all tested during my work for my master's degree. And I work those into the novel because I was thinking, if I'm going to get people with ADHD to read this, they're not going to be interested in it unless it's something that really, really catches them and grabs them. And self-help book wouldn't do that as well as a story. That was, my feeling. And also from when I was teaching reading, I would read aloud to the kids from time to time. And it was funny to see how the 7th and 8th graders responded to that, almost like the kindergartners did. So I knew that a good story would really catch them more than if I just, you know, did a self-help book.
And you did this, the boy in the story, mm-hmm. his name is Michael Taylor. Mm-hmm. And what are the how does Jenna, the teacher, recognize that there's something special about this child?
As soon as he walks into the classroom, because as a teacher, you spot him right away. It's very easy to see. Now when they talk about they don't talk about ADD anymore. It's ADHD, because most of the kids that are coming in with this issue have hyperactivity thrown in the mix. They're the ones that just pop right out. They're like in kindergarten, they were like little Mexican jumping beans, you know, in the classroom. And I wanted to make Michael a high schooler, because a lot of there used to be, not so much now, but back in the day when I was really researching this condition, there was so much denial on the part of the parents that they just did not want to hear that there was anything amiss with their child. They blamed it on laziness, lack of motivation, he's just oppositional, he's defiant, you know. And it wasn't that. It was just part of the ADHD. And so what you would see was parents pulling, as soon as the kid was a big enough problem in one school that they, you know, they had to do something, they would pull him out and put him somewhere else. And Michael is a result of that. He's been moved around.
You're shuffled around, and nobody's taken the time to concentrate on him and to find out sort of what makes him tick.
Right.
What? And how to get that ticking.
How to get the ticking in sync with everybody else's
exactly.
ticking. And Jenna is a real Jersey girl. She's stubborn and she's volatile and she's just, you know, once she sets her mind to something, she's going to do it no matter what the cost. And she initially, when he comes into her classroom, she just wants him out. And that's a very common reaction. You know, you go in there the first day of school and you're just ready for this wonderful new year. And then this kid walks in who you know is going to make your life miserable until they leave in June, and you go down to the guidance office, which she does, and her friend, or the guidance counselor, is a good friend, and she says, "I want him out. You know, what is this? I can't deal with this child. He did this and this and this, and he was disruptive and disrespectful." And the guidance counselor talks her off the wall. You know, that's what they do. And she then gets a writing assignment from him where he had to write a sin cane. And when she reads it, he writes about what it's like inside his head. And she's so moved by it and overwhelmed by it, and she recognizes this is a cry for help. So she decides she's going to get this kid help no matter what it takes. And that creates a lot of problems for her, because his dad is very influential in the community, and he's also in total denial about this boy and doesn't want to hear it. Whereas the mom is she's more receptive, and she realizes that this kid needs help and she wants to get him the help. So it sets up a conflict, and she gets into a lot of trouble. A lot of the school politics are in there. The thing that's been most gratifying to me is when I have teachers that contact me and they said, you know, what it's like, you've really shown it, you've shown the profession, you know, warts and all. There's the wonderful, satisfying side of knowing that you're making a difference in these children's lives, but then there's all the school board politics and working with administrators who have to deal with the school board and the parents, and all of this enters into what a teacher goes through, you know, on a daily basis. And they really felt that I showed that very realistically. So that's gratifying.
You know, it's so important. Teachers should always, I know it's a difficult profession in so many ways. Mm-hmm. It's, as you said, you're faced with so many challenges. I recently interviewed Poet Laureate, mm-hmm. Juan Herrera. Mm-hmm. He's going to officially take his office in September. And the interesting thing about you know, him, and when I was interviewing him, is how vivid his memories are of his third grade teacher. Mm-hmm. His third grade teacher made all the difference in his life. She inspired him. She believed in him. She encouraged him. And I was so happy to hear that she is 92 years old and has lived long enough to see that her student, a student that she took special interest in, because Juan is a Chicano, of course, and, and so entering the school system, he was had been, of course, a native Spanish speaker, but he entered the American school system, and she was there. She was there for him, for and she inspired him. And what happens? I mean, you know, almost like 55 years later, there he is, the poet laureate of the United States, and how thrilling it must be for her as a teacher to know this. And so that's why I always tell teachers, no matter how tired you are, no matter how hard it is, to remember that, that the memories of a third grade teacher are so, or third grade teacher or seventh grade teacher are so important. You you know, when a person can go back and say, that teacher inspired me. And I recently, another interview I had was with Luke Reynolds, a seventh grade teacher who wrote The Looney Experiment. And his book is based on his teacher, his seventh grade teacher, who inspired him. And so teaching is a difficult profession, but if you do it well, and if you do it with the dedication that obviously, and the enthusiasm, I wish people could see your face, because when you're talking about teaching, you're so enthusiastic, and that's important to keep this in mind and to remember what you can do, how you can inspire students and inspire people, and it lasts a lifetime.
Oh, it does. Yes.
And of course, there's also the opposite, like you said. You talk about warts and all. My third grade teacher made me sit on my left hand.
Oh, no.
Because she did not believe people should write with their left hand. And so I remember her as vividly, and I remember her very vividly, because that I spent the whole, you know, first 2 months of third grade sitting on my hand. So teachers, remember this. You are not forgotten. I mean, I hope she's out there, 92 years old, and is listening to me today and remembers what she did to me, because it was a tough time.
I can imagine.
I mean, it's not easy when you're left-handed to write with your right hand for 2 whole months, because I was afraid to tell my parents, because, I mean, she said that's the way it's done. She told me. I mean, I believed her. We had moved down from the country and into the city, into Detroit. And she told me that's the way it was done. And so I thought that was a city thing. You know, I thought, what do I know? I'm from northern Michigan. I'm, you know, a Uper. I thought, well, only left-handed people could be from up north. And in Detroit, in the big city, everybody had to write with their right hand. So, you know, so teachers, remember that. You have a big, big responsibility. And so I think that your book, and, you know, it's, of course, you've tackled a particularly interesting subject and a relevant subject for today, Project Junebug. Now, you have a website where there's more information about it. What is your website?
It's JackieMinitti.com.
Okay. And the book is also available in paperback and on Kindle at Amazon. And I highly recommend it. It, you know, everybody nowadays knows somebody who has ADHD, whether it's for yourself, or for somebody in your family, go and get this book, and you will share in the enthusiasm that Jackie has put into her book. So it was a great pleasure to talk to you today.
Oh, thank you.
And,
you
too. Best of luck with this, and also with your second book, which is Jacqueline. Also available on Amazon, and you can read more about it on Jackie's website.
Charles Ruttenberg Realty proudly sponsors Joy on Paper with Patsy Gill. Charles Ruttenberg sets the standard of excellence with residential and commercial real estate transactions and can help you on your next transaction, whether that is for a second home, investment, or downsizing. Call us today at 727-538-9200 extension 2 and allow me to help you. I'm John Rakowski, the broker at Charles Ruttenberg Realty.
Are you looking for the perfect gift? Going to a wedding? A special birthday? The Silver Queen is the place to go. Don't settle for the ordinary. At the Silver Queen, you will find a unique gift. Things that you won't find at the mall. From beautiful photo frames to silver and china. Guys, looking for that perfect ring? You'll find it at the Silver Queen. And don't forget their bridal registry. Located at 1350 West Bay Drive in Largo. Visit their website, silverqueen.com. They have some wonderful coupons. And when you go to the store, tell them that Patsy with a Z sent you.
If you're in the market for your next car, then the place to shop is autoshopper.com. You'll have access to hundreds of dealers right here in the area. And you can search over millions of cars nationwide on autoshopper.com. Autoshopper.com is in hundreds of locations in the Tampa Bay area. Find your next car by taking advantage of all the power and reputation of autoshopper.com. From your desktop, you can read car reviews, automotive news, calculate payments, use our tools to research, and get a Carfax vehicle history report at autoshopper.com. This is the publication to pick up and read when you're looking to purchase your next car. Log on to autoshopper.com and search for your special vehicle. And if you want to sell your vehicle, then advertise it in autoshopper.com magazine. The readers can view a picture of your car and call you directly. It's all happening at autoshopper.com, your auto buying and selling source. Pick up the magazine today or log on to autoshopper.com, the premier source for car buying or selling. autoshopper.com.
Some people don't believe in mermaids. Hope that's not you, because they exist at Wickiwatchee Springs State Park off US 19 and State Road 50, just north of Spring Hill. Since 1947, the magic of the mermaids have been entertaining visitors at the 538-acre Springs Park. Come and watch in the 400-seat submerged theater, The Little Mermaid Show at 11 a.m. and 3 p.m. daily. Wickiwatchee State Park offers mermaid shows, reptile shows, boat tours, and swimming in the pristine spring at Buccaneer Bay. Wickiwatchee State Park is a perfect backdrop for wedding receptions, birthday parties, picnics, meetings, retreats, family reunions, or just to relax on the white sandy beach. Step back in time when things were much simpler and enjoyable. Spend the day at an original theme park. Call 352-592-5656 or log on to wickiwatchee.com for upcoming events, hours, and ticket pricing. Wickiwatchee Springs State Park, where mermaids do exist.
Go yard is a metaphor used in baseball, meaning to hit a home run. Life struggles can make you feel like you just struck out. It's times like these that we need a little batting practice to pick ourselves back up and get back in the game. Whether you are dealing with marital issues, drug addiction, rebellious teens, anxiety, depression, or just generally having a bad day, call Mama Mac. If life has you down 0-2, before you strike out, learn to go yard. Go yard with Mama Mac on this radio station, Thursdays, 6 o'clock.
Did you know there's a sprawling botanical paradise right in your own backyard? Come visit Sunken Gardens. Located at 1825 4th Street North, it's St. Petersburg's oldest living museum. This 100-year-old garden is home to some of the oldest tropical plants in the region. Unwind as you stroll through meandering paths, lush with exotic plants from around the world. Explore cascading waterfalls, beautiful demonstration gardens, and more than 50,000 tropical plants and flowers. Sunken Gardens provides garden tours, horticultural programs, special events, field trips, weddings, private or corporate rentals, and much more. Call 727-551-3102 for more information. That's 727-551-3102. Sunken Gardens, 1825 4th Street North, right in the heart of Old Northeast St. Petersburg. Call 727-551-3102.